come along with us as we explore the broad world of preservation and the work being done to preserve, interpret, and save our past in a 21st century world. From aquaculture to historic foodways to forensic modeling, we're talking weekly with experts from across the globe. This is your host, Nick Redding. Welcome to PreserveCast. This is Nick Redding, and you're listening to PreserveCast today. We're thrilled to be sitting down with Winslow Hasty, who is the president and CEO of the Historic Charleston Foundation, just a legacy organization in the field of historic preservation, and has been at this work for a long time. And we're going to be talking with Winslow all about his work there and specifically the challenges surrounding the Nathaniel Russell House and their hope for the future and the optimism that they have for that site and what that site might look like moving forward. They have, you know, been in the news quite a bit, and we want to give Winslow and the folks at the Historic Charleston Foundation an opportunity to tell us where they're headed and their thoughts and, you know, position on all of this. And we're excited to do that because it's a big preservation story, and we're thrilled to be able to have the opportunity to do that with Winslow. So before we get started, you and I have known each other for a little while, but I don't know everything about your background. So where'd you grow up? What led you to preservation? And normally the way we then take that is, what was your first job in the field?
Great. Thanks, Nick. And thanks to you all for hosting me today. I appreciate the opportunity. I grew up in Charleston downtown in the historic district. My family on my father's side has deep roots in the Charleston area. I never, if you asked me as a kid, I mean, I just thought that's what cities look like, right? I didn't know that it was special. It just, you know, I biked around and loved it, and it was an incredible community to grow up in. But to me, it was normal. It's not until you grow older and get some perspective and travel and start to see the world that you realize how special a place like Charleston is. And part of it too was not just growing up and sort of through osmosis, you know, appreciating architecture and urban design in the historic district of Charleston. But my family also owns a historic site outside of Charleston. It's a former plantation that's internationally known for its gardens. And it's a public historic site that is still owned by my family. And it's been in my family for 12 generations. So and it's adjacent to Drayton Hall. My family, I come from the Drayton family, and it's called Magnolia Gardens. And it's sort of the ancestral seed of the Drayton family. And John Drayton, who went and built Drayton Hall, was my whatever, great, 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 great grandfather. So, it was part of my blood and part of my growing up. But when I did a sort of traditional liberal arts education and, you know, didn't really know how I would apply that in the real world, like a lot of people, which is fine. But I thought at one point, I studied a lot of, you know, English, but also art history and architectural history, and, lived in France for a semester and studied a lot of art and architectural history there. And so I always knew that was an interest of mine. And so I thought, well, you know, after a while, after I graduated from undergrad, that I would go to architecture school, like what seemed like a natural path. Well, I was mistaken. I started an architecture program and quickly learned that I had zero talent as an architect. And frankly, it just was not a fit at all. But I took a building materials conservation class as part of that program and sort of opened up my eyes to a whole world. You know, there's sort of an industry and a profession around preservation and old buildings. And so through that professor, I learned that there actually were graduate programs in historic preservation. And I actually had a friend who did the program in Columbia, and she was there at the time in New York. And so I talked to her. And anyway, so I ended up going and getting a graduate degree at the University of Georgia in preservation. But I was more interested in sort of land use policy, urban planning. You know, I was sort of more of a policy person. You know, I was interested in the environmental aspects of preservation, not as much the technical, you know, conservation aspects per se, but really more the policy side and preservation law and land use. So that's kind of how it started. I did that program at Georgia, and it sort of leaned in that direction. And anyway, so it was a great experience.
So you graduate from there, and where do you land in the field?
So my wife and I had always wanted to live on the West Coast, and so we ended up moving to San Francisco, and I had some connections through my mentor at Georgia, Pratt Cassidy, who a lot of people in the preservation world may remember. He was a kind of a lion in the preservation world back in the 90s and aughts. He's retired now, but he had a lot of connections around the country and introduced me to a lot of folks out there. And I ultimately got a job with a small architecture firm that specialized in preservation called Carey and Company. And it was a smaller, there's two other big firms, Page and Turnbull and Architectural Resources Group out in San Francisco. But Carey and Company was sort of the small kid on the block, but a great architecture and planning firm. And I worked on the planning side of things. So worked on tax credit application, survey work, National Register nominations, you know, out in California, they have a state CEQA, a state law that, so they have to do a lot of historic resource evaluations to determine whether or not something is, you know, deemed historic. So we were doing a lot of evaluation work. And it was awesome. It exposed me to a ton of different aspects of preservation, working with both the private sector and the public sector. We had a great, so we were on retainer with the Western Office of the National Park Service, which was based in San Francisco at the time. And so we had this historic resource evaluation sort of retainer whenever they would need, you know, help in that regard. So it was one of the coolest projects I've ever worked on. And I kind of thought, oh, if this is what professional life is like, I'm all in, because they sent me around to national parks all around the West to look at Mission 66 resources at Joshua Tree and Death Valley and, a lot of other lesser known national parks in the West. And then ultimately I got sent to Maui in the Big Island of Hawaii for a month, and I was being flown around in helicopters and being dropped into craters, Haleakala, the crater on Maui, to go tromp around and evaluate Park Service structures in the crater. And I thought, man, this is pretty awesome. Of course, it was all sort of downhill from there, but it was pretty incredible. So yeah. I did that for a couple of years, and then ultimately got a job for the city and county of San Francisco as a preservation planner. They had never really had a planner with a degree in preservation, particularly from the East Coast, which out there is like Shangri-La, right? And being from Charleston and having an actual degree in preservation was very attractive to them. So I was able to kind of lead a team in San Francisco. And it was an incredible process, and loved that work, and worked there for about 4 years.
And then obviously you made your way back to your home place. The calling was strong to come back, and you've been in your current position now 5 years. Is that right? Something like
six years. Six. Yeah. Right. COVID is the ultimate distorter of time. So I have to constantly remind myself, I have to like count. I'm like on my fingers. So it's been actually over 6 years now.
But with the organization for a longer period.
Yeah, I started in 2006. So I moved back to Charleston in late 05 and got the job in 06 at Historic Charleston, and started as the director of preservation, sort of overseeing all of our preservation programs, and then ultimately inherited the museums department during the Great Recession, and then led both of those group teams or departments for a number of years, and then kind of moved up to a chief preservation officer position. And then they did the foundation. When my predecessor decided to retire, I was sort of hoping, I've been around, I'm a known quantity. She kind of positioned me as the heir apparent, but the wisdom of the board was to do a national search, which of course at the time I wasn't thrilled about, but it actually was a smart decision. Because it made me really work to not only think, introspectively about what I wanted to accomplish professionally for the organization, but also to like really get good at articulating that. They ran me through the ringer. I thought, I know all you people, you know me, we've been working together a long time, but I had probably a dozen interviews. But anyway, they did a national search and I ultimately prevailed there. So
for people who aren't familiar, and we have listeners all across the globe, so it's probably maybe perhaps the international who isn't as familiar with the Historic Charleston Foundation, but I'm sure you have your elevator pitch about what it is. But give people a sense for the scale of it, the legacy of it, and the sorts of work and things that you work on.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a fairly large, pretty multifaceted preservation organization. We were chartered in 1947, so just 2 years ago, we had our 75th anniversary, and which I know the National Trust has this year, I believe. I think we're celebrating in the fall 75 years in New Orleans. But so we've been around a while, and it was originally started. We already had a local preservation organization town, the Preservation Society of Charleston, which was formed. It was the first local preservation organization to be formed in the country in 1920. So there was already for 27 years, there had been a local group, but the sort of city leaders at the time in the late 40s were feeling like there needed to be a separate organization that was heavily focused on sort of policy and looking at zoning and policy and looking at a kind of wider swath of issues as it relates to the growth and development of Charleston, which is so funny when you go back and look at some of the founding documents and the sort of sky is falling, material that you read about the influx, the hordes of tourists and, all the development pressures. And I'm just thinking, okay, late 40s in Charleston. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Charleston. It was slow then. And I know probably late 40s, real slow. But, Charlestonians are want to be a little extreme in there. But nonetheless, they saw a need for a more policy-oriented organization. And this relates to our conversation later, but part of our founding document said that we would not own house museums. That was not what we were going to do because, of course, at the time, that was very much sort of the standard formula. A lot of times these local preservation organizations were founded around a rally around a landmark building or something. And so that was not the intention anyway. And so we've grown over time. We're most well known probably within preservation circles for founding the first revolving fund in the country, which happened in the late 50s. So about 10 years into the organization, we founded the first revolving fund and started focusing on sort of neighborhood scale preservation projects. So it wasn't sort of individual landmarks, but it was really looking at how we could purchase lots of buildings, derelict buildings in a singular neighborhood, which we did in the neighborhood of Ansonboro. And obviously, in that model grew in Charleston, and of course, has been copied and used all over the country. And it is an extremely powerful tool, as you know, for preservation. So we have a revolving fund, which is still in existence. We have a very robust easements program. So we have over 400 properties that we hold either restrictive covenants or perpetual easements on, not just in downtown in the historic district, but in surrounding historic districts and other towns and rural areas outside of Charleston. So our reach is not just the peninsula. A lot of people just affiliate us with downtown Charleston, but we we sort of really look at a sort of regional, I mean, a bulk of our work is downtown, but, you know, we do a lot of other work outside of Charleston too. And so we have a robust easements program. we have now, 7 years after forming, we went against our marching orders and ultimately did purchase a property, actually originally not necessarily with the intent of operating as a house museum, but just to save it. And that was the Nathaniel Russell House. That was in 1955. It became our headquarters, but then we quickly realized we needed to try to generate some revenue. And so we opened it up for tours very quickly. And so then we all of a sudden had a house museum. And then, you know, fast forward to 1995, we ended up purchasing the Aiken Rhett House, which is an incredible property further uptown in the historic district of Charleston, from the Charleston Museum, who's a you know, partner organization in town that was struggling to deal with it because it's a monster of a property. And so we took it on. And so we still own and operate that as a house museum. So we have two house museums. And let's see, we have a very robust retail program that was started in the 1970s, again, looking at a diversification of revenue and getting creative. That was one of the things I will say that the foundation has always been very strong in, which is sort of being entrepreneurial and thinking creatively about revenue and diversifying revenue. And that leads, again, I'm sort of planting some seeds for the conversation we're going to have because, you know, at times I think it sort of ultimately made us into a very multifaceted and at times hard to manage organization with lots of tentacles. And then the last area of our work, which is super important and is growing in need and in scope, is our sort of overall advocacy, which is a general umbrella term that I use, that we use to really speak to our, you know, our work within the community around policy issues, around, you know, individual projects. Of course, we go to almost every public meeting that happens in Charleston, whether it be the Board of Architectural Review, which regulates design review and everything else in the historic district and has a huge purview, to zoning boards, to planning commission, city council, county council. You know, we're very engaged and a very trusted and relied upon voice in the community around individual projects, but also broader policy issues as it relates to zoning. You know, and this is also relevant to our conversation, which is, as we all know, the kind of the scope or umbrella of preservation has expanded greatly over the last several decades. And so, you know, we're almost more of a planning, sort of smart growth planning advocacy group as much as we are a preservation advocacy group. I mean, we get involved in transportation and mobility issues, affordable housing. Tourism management is a huge area of our work just because it's Charleston has seen insane growth in tourism. And that has, you know, impacts both for the livability for our residents, but also sort of physical impacts to the city. So, I think that covers it.
Yeah. I mean, what I was going to say is, you know, as you're sort of trying to pull it all together here, is that I think this conversation about Nathaniel Russell is important for us to have, but it's also important, I think, in the context of Historic Charleston Foundation, because it is so dynamic and because there's so much going on there, is in some ways, I feel like, is a microcosm of the whole preservation sort of environment, the preservation community writ large nationally, right? Like everything's kind of wrapped up in this one story, in this one organization, because you guys have been at it so long and you have such robust programs and operations, and you're involved in so many different ways that I think a lot of preservation groups around the country can see at least some aspect of their work reflected in what you're dealing with. And what you're dealing with is what in some ways we're all dealing with as preservation, as you say, changes, right? And so, you know, like I think most people who listen know that PreserveCast is powered by Preservation Maryland. And, you know, we have a whole smart growth effort and operation as well, because it's how do you how do you save historic and legacy communities if you're not involved in the conversation around planning and the future of those communities, whether that be infill or redevelopment, all those sorts of things. So I think many of us look to what's going on in Charleston and the Historic Charleston Foundation in particular as sort of the bellwether for where preservation is headed. And so that's why I think the conversation around Nathaniel Russell, but also your strategic plan. And so maybe we'll head there first, because that's what sort of precipitates the conversation around the house itself. So like many organizations, you go into strategic planning, and that plan that came out was pretty far reaching and pretty progressive in its view of preservation. Without going into the nitty gritty detail of the planning or the plan even itself, What's the 30,000 foot version of this? What is it? What kind of vision is it charting for the organization, and over what period of time?
Yeah, thanks. We hadn't done a in-depth strategic. Well, we hadn't done a strategic plan in a decade, so it was overdue. Obviously, that meant it hadn't been done under my leadership. And frankly, the last time we did it, it was not. A deep strategic plan. I don't know how else to say it, but it kind of was sort of skim the surface, and it's like, let's review things. And oh, we do it. It sort of felt a little bit more like a box checking exercise than it really was like a deep introspection about where we are, and where we want to go. It more was like an affirmation of, hey, everything we're doing is great. So we really hadn't had a deep introspection about the organization in a long time. And certainly not under my leadership. And so when my board was pushing hard, and obviously the 75th anniversary gave us an opportunity to kind of look back and sort of where we've been and where we are today. And so the timing was really good on the heels of a successful 75th anniversary to kind of look to the future. And so when the board started, clamoring about the need to move forward with a strategic plan, I was very strong in saying, hey, I'm all in. But I want to make sure we have real clear goals, and not only clear goals, but also a clear sort of action plan as to how to implement this over time. And that it's clear on who is going to implement what, whether it be board, committees, staff, working with community partners, city hall, who are all the players, and kind of mapping that out was really important to me. So we hired a consultant, and the plan is, they keep saying 3 to 5 years, and I would keep hacking away at the three. I'm like, this is a 5-year plan, because I don't know if I'm ready to do this again in 3 years. But and I think that's a little short. I mean, it takes time to kind of ramp up, particularly given what we went through. And so it's a 5-year plan in my mind. And, part of it was really saying, let's lay everything out on the table. And this ties back to all the, talking about retail and museums and advocacy and all the various things that we do, and maybe some brand confusion within the community too, as more and more people move to Charleston who really don't, back in the day, it was sort of like everyone was from here and they knew, oh, there's Preservation Society and there's Historic Charleston, and yeah, they're both great, and yeah, we support them both, and we understand who does what and what roles they play. But it's confusing to outsiders who move here, and they're like, okay, this town isn't that big. Why are there two local preservation organizations? How do y'all complement each other? Who does what well? And, so there was some brand confusion. So that was a big part of it too, was sort of articulating in a more concise way sort of what our unique value proposition is and sort of how we position ourselves in the community. And part of that was sort of laying everything out on the table, and you probably know this, Nick, from your work, but a lot of times you get facilitators and experts come in, and they're like, look, there are no sacred cows. Like, a lot of times, if you want to double down in one area, that means, from a capacity and resource standpoint, you have to stop doing something. And at least from my experience in the nonprofit sector, stopping doing things is not easy. Right. And you can say that, but it's like, oh, but that's what we've always done. And, you have people who love various aspects of the work that you do. So, but and that became a theme. Like, we really need to look at everything hard and look at, but also in the context of where we want to go in the future. And so part of it was a kind of update of our mission. And I'm going to just share that with you. Our mission had been a little gray and kind of wordy, and it was sort of a word salad, and it was too long. And so we kind of wanted, that was the start. And so we ended up with an updated mission. It's not a new, I mean, it is a new mission, but we're not abdicating the past, but it is to advocate for a future for Charleston that honors and protects its people, places, culture, and community. And that's still a lot, right? But I think the key piece was advocate and future. We wanted to be very future forward and future looking. I think there's a lot of brand confusion in preservation, that preservation's all about stopping growth, stopping progress, you know, looking back, being mired in the past, you know, obstructionist, all those things that we know are a lot of times the preservation movement is criticized for. So we landed on that, and that was sort of the lens through which we looked at everything. And, you know, the house museums came up, well, retail came up first, and it was like, this retail thing has gotten to be a behemoth that needs to be, we need to kind of shrink this thing, because it just got, it was too big and too complicated. And frankly, I don't know a thing about retail. And, you know, a lot of my board was like, I didn't join this board to talk about, you know, selling shot glasses in the market or whatever, you know, and I'm sort of teasing, and we have great things in our retail, but retail is a complicated industry to begin with. There's so much change going on all the time, and it just became a resource and attention suck. And so we first started by talking about closing down a shop, which was a big deal. And I'm still getting hate mail for that, but we are closing one of our beloved local stores, but just to kind of shrink that footprint. And actually, we now have decided to outsource our entire retail program to a third party who specializes in that. A lot of museums, you know, and cultural sites do that. So that's been a big change. So that was sort of first on the kind of chopping block, but then, and that sounds a little brutal, chopping block, but, you know, sort of looking at things that we could maybe move away from so we could focus on the future and what the needs of the Charleston community were. You know, then the museums, of course, came up. And, you know, this has been a topic. And Nick, you know well, I mean, Dick Moe was prescient back in 2002 with his seminal article about Are There Too Many House Museums, which was dropped a bomb on the preservation community. And it still resonates today. And, you know, I go back and have gone back multiple times to read it. And then he did a kind of 10-year kind of in 2012, I think, an update article to that. But, you know, this has been a conversation for a long time about the house museum model and, you know, is it dead or is it relevant today? And, you know, we started really looking at our capital needs, having these two house museums, and the Russell House was in great shape. You know, we've invested a lot in it. It's restored. It's, you know, really solid. The Aiken Red House, you know, we've taken the Drayton Hall model, the preservation model, which is, you know, leave it as is. It's not climate controlled. It's, you know, something like 18,000 square feet. It's a huge property with incredible outbuildings. And it has this ability, you know, the ability to convey the history of the institution of slavery in Charleston in a way that no other cultural site can, particularly on the peninsula. And we did an assessment of the capital needs there just to shore it up, not restore it, but just to shore it up. And, you know, we were looking in the $3 to $5 million range just to kind of not do anything sexy, but just kind of keep things going. And so then it kind of begged this question of, okay, and we were starting to see some decline in visitation in our house museums. And which, you know, we used to be insulated. I would go to trust conferences and there'd be all these sessions on, you know, oh, you know, woe is me, the house museum is dead. And I would sort of chuckle to myself, like, ah, ha, ha, that's too bad for you. But, you know, we're in Charleston and everyone loves Charleston and our tourism economy is so strong. And our visitation had been going up for a long time, but it had sort of flatlined and then had started to decrease. And so anyway, not to get into all of it, but, you know, kind of decided that maybe the Russell House, you know, a lot of new people moving to town didn't even know that it was ours. A lot of locals don't really go there. You know, it's more sort of serving a tourism economy. And maybe we need to shrink our footprint in that regard. And so there's this idea, which was very painful to me at the beginning of, well, at first there was a discussion of both house museums. Maybe we should just get out of the business altogether. And then I made a strong argument about the Aiken Brett. I don't think we can sell. We haven't done our work is not done there. Your work's never done, but we had a lot of work to do there. And, but then the Russell, and then sort of this Russell House thing came up, and it was in retrospect a little too much of an echo chamber within the strategic planning committee that I had. But that started to grow over time. So,
and so obviously, you know, kind of burying the lead here, but the decision is made that what, and I don't want to mischaracterize the decision, because I think that there was a lot of mischaracterization of it. So I'm going to let you characterize it the way that you guys saw it from the perspective of the strategic plan.
Yeah. So, you know, it, and part of the problem was it was such a bombshell of a decision, and we were so worried about confidentiality and things leaking. And, you know, I have staff that it would affect them. I, you know, have supporters and donors who would be upset. And so we wanted to make sure that however we managed messaging, that it was done in an organized, structured way, which of course did not happen. But, you know, the decision was made. It was very controversial. I'll just share within the board, you know, there was a very vocal minority that were, you know, vehemently opposed. And while we could have gotten the vote through in the early fall, you know, the wisdom of my board, and I appreciate that of them, was like, let's don't cram this down the throats. We don't want to divide our board. Let's take our time and let the folks who are not in support of selling the property to, you know, do their due diligence and ask the questions and do their research and whatnot. So we punted on the decision until November, the end of November, and ultimately it was decided by the almost a majority of the board. It was almost unanimous that we would sell the property. Unfortunately, what then happened, and there had been rumors, of course, Charleston's a small community, but there was a leak of that information to the press, and I came out of a doctor's appointment to an utter nightmare situation. We were going to roll it out in a kind of more calculated way, and anyway, it didn't work out that way. And, you know, and the response was swift and intense and wide reaching. And I knew it was going to be controversial, but I thought it would be from a small group of people.
I was just going to ask, is this what you expected?
No. And, you know, I mean, I'm a museums guy. I mean, I love house museums. While I'm more in the preservation and advocacy from a professional standpoint, I mean, you know, I've managed those museums. I love the Russell House. It's incredible property. But, you know, you just started, so the concept got a little socialized. And I thought of the, you know, the resources that we can then apply into the Aiken Rhett, which needed a lot, and the opportunities there. The Aiken Rhett lends itself to more creative programming because of the layout of the property.
And because there's not that culture of preciousness, because it's,
that's right.
It's raw, it's real. And so there's,
And so, you know, and there's not the velvet ropes and everything's restored and precious and untouchable. And, you know, we can barely use the rooms because you don't really want to move the furniture and the house while it's gorgeous and large, it's the way it's divided up is hard, and it's located right in the heart of the downtown historic district. And so we can't really do like music stuff there. And I'm very interested in breathing life into these houses, right? And that's art installations,
right,
and creative programming, and, you know, performing arts and music, and, you know, Title I school children, adult programming. I mean, you name it. I think that's the only way, from my perspective, that these properties remain relevant is, sure, not just being visited by tourists, but that they are a part of the fabric of the community, and the community is interacting with them in different ways over the years. And in my mind, I was like, I thought a bunch of downtown people would be thrilled because they're like, ooh, because there's a lot of backlash against all the tourism. And, you know, this house is in the middle of the South of Broad neighborhood, which is the most affected by tourism, with all the carriages and walking tours. And I mean, it is sometimes does feel like Disney, particularly this time of year. It's crazy. And the tourism economy has exploded over the last, you know, 15, 20 years. It's really kind of amazing. It's been on this exponential growth curve. And So I thought, you know, there'd be a lot of people, thank you, you know, you're reducing your footprint, you know, and while I always knew there was going to be, and I talked to folks at the trust, I mean, Tom Mays was a great resource to me and others at the trust talking about, you know, some of the, you know, pitfalls that they had dealt with. And I talked to other consultants who were experts in this area. And, you know, one of the things they said was, you know, taking something out of the public domain and privatizing it is a huge deal. And while I understood that, I don't think my board as much understood that. And so that really, at the end of the day, was the big thing, was this idea that you're taking something away from the community. And so the intensity of the backlash was very surprising. And also the where it came from. I mean, it came from young people. We have a young sort of affiliate group, supporter group called what we call the Preservisionists. And that group was probably the most rabid and intense in their backlash, which I was sort of like, while they've done some events there, it was surprising to me. And then of course, you know, old guard Charleston people, new people that moved to town, you know, board members, committee members, former board members, then, you know, our colleagues, Williamsburg, and Winterthur, and, you know, you name it, all around the country. And then the world, I mean, I was getting hate mail from the UK. I mean, it was so intense. And, you know, at first we were like, nope, we made a decision. We got to be resolved here. And that was where the board was kind of through December. And then kind of right before Christmas, it just reached this crazy pitch. And people were talking about, you know, abandoning us. And anyway, it just, all of a sudden I was like, you know, this backlash is very revealing. You know, this place matters. You know, it's like classic trust thing. This place matters. It's like, and it was news to me. I have to say, I was very surprised.
Well, I think it's a reminder for the advocacy organization, I suppose, that advocacy works.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and you heard it from loud and clear grassroots response, you know,
thank you for saying that, because that was what I ultimately said to my board when I made my sort of very passionate appeal back in early January to say we need to reverse. And it was like, listen, we just had this huge thing with Union Pier where we rallied the community around an issue and educated them on it, and they came out in droves because of our work, and we shut this thing down. And if, you know, and that's the basis, the foundation of our work. And if we can't do that ourselves, then we are crazy hypocrites. And, you know, it really, it undermines our credibility in the community. And we are a community-based organization. So we're not going to listen to the community, then shame on us. Right. And, you know, there's a point you just got to take it. You got an egg on the face. Okay, we hear you. We are listening. You know, and I think part of it, too, was it's a physical thing. You know, so much of our work is a little squishy, right? And it's sometimes hard to articulate. But when you have a physical object, and Charleston is undergoing so much change right now with new people, new development, you know, just it's the not just downtown, but the region is changing dramatically. And so, you know, they see these sort of landmarks as a kind of, okay, that's going to always be there. You know, this is something that I can peg, you know, Charleston to. And then when they're like, all of a sudden, historic Charleston is abandoning the community and selling this thing, it became the symbol, right? That even we were going to, you know, sell our souls or, you know, cash in. There was, of course, this whole narrative that I was lining my pockets and board members were, you know, going to take the money and run to St. Bart's or something. I don't know. It was, you know, things. And, you know, and we could talk about the evils of social media, but everything was very magnified through social media and, you know, change.org petitions. And it was intense.
So you change course. I mean, obviously that, you know, you've mentioned that the decision is, no, we're going to keep it. I'm curious, you know, one of the things that oftentimes I feel like is somebody who, you know, runs an organization, and I'm curious if how this played out with you is, you know, people can get really heated about an organizational decision and want you to change direction. And you're like, okay, finally, you know, you come to that realization like you guys did for a variety of reasons. But then are you going to help us on the other side, right? Like we have considerable needs for Aiken Rhett. Breathing life into Nathaniel Russell is going to be a challenge, right? And maintaining its relevance beyond this moment. So how have you sensed, is there a change in that as well, or is that not as fast and furious?
You know, so it's a great question. And we sort of have been, you know, assessing that every day. And there was a group, a very vocal group that were very pleased with our reversal. And they said, listen, you need to leverage this intensity and this energy and attention into something positive, like turn this into a fundraiser. And, you know, and then, but as we kind of consider that, just started to feel a little opportunistic and a little funny, right? And we felt like, listen, we've got some repair work to do within the community. We've got to show our commitment. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, okay, great. So you just reverse, like, what does that mean? You're going to sell it next year or in 5 years, or, you know, what does this really mean? And is your heart really in it, or you just did it because you got pressured into it? And I can tell you that it's the former. I mean, I heard and I was energized by it, to be totally honest. It was like, this is a referendum and this is a challenge that's been thrown at our feet. And we either accept it and accept it with gusto and figure out a path forward, or this is for naught, right? This is a kind of a hollow exercise. And so, you know, it takes time, not only to kind of work internally and try to figure out what that looks like, but also within the community. And so we just wanted the kind of dust to settle. At one point we were going to do an event in February and, you know, and try to bring people in and frankly have, you know, collection envelopes there, like, hey, we need your help. But we figured we need to be a little more methodical about how we approach that and be very clear needs are. And so we have assembled an incredible team of sort of experts in lots of different areas, including education and historic site interpretation, preservation, conservation, you know, kind of historic site management, events. Frankly, it's because that's another big thing, is how you balance, you know, events and programming, innovative programming, with, you know, the being a good steward of not only the property but the collection that you have in the house. So we've got a lot of things that we want to navigate, and so it's taken some time to not only identify who those people would be, but then to convene that group. So we haven't even had our first meeting. We're going to meet in a couple of weeks. And in that group is really going to be challenged, along with my museum staff and some board members, to really, you know, to really ask those hard questions. Like, what does it mean to be a house museum in the 21st century? What does it mean to be relevant in the community and not just for our visitors from out of town, but for the community? What does that mean? And how do we position ourselves best to, you know, to do that in a meaningful way, that's also kind of at the vanguard of what historic sites are doing around the country. And so we've been doing, you know, obviously research about what sites are doing interesting things. And I was able to bring in, I did have a pretty large departure of staff who were very deflated by the decision and felt kind of betrayed a little bit. And so several of my museum staff left. And so, you know, rebuilding has been tricky and not easy, but we're on that path now. And so I've got some help now, which is great. And so I'm excited. I mean, this is, you know, this is the kind of stuff that we do, and, you know, sort of asking the hard questions and charting a course. And you know, we were talking about even hosting a symposium in the fall around this topic and bringing in folks from around the country, because I know, like you said, this is not insulated to Charleston. This is happening all over.
No, and yeah, I mean, that's why I was really excited to have the opportunity and appreciate you being so willing to come on and be open and honest and transparent about this, which is what I would expect out of you. But I just, you know, I know this was a challenging moment. But I think that there's so much value in here, not just to understand what happened in Charleston, But for people around the country who are practitioners who work in this field, who maybe are charged with maintaining a historic house museum in a community that doesn't even have nearly the level of visitation or support that a Charleston does, to understand what happened there. To understand the public reaction, to understand how you pivot and then change course on a decision. Just like Historic Charleston Foundation led on revolving funds, a half a century ago, I see you guys leading at this moment on this conversation and understanding, okay, community gave us this feedback. They gave us this new charge. Like you said, it's landed at our feet. How do we then take this and do something with it that still meets the needs of the community, that still addresses relevance? We've had Bonnie McDonald on from Landmark Illinois talking about relevance and preservation. And so how do you still do that, right? People want it, but then how does it maintain relevance? Because you guys aren't in it for the short, you're in it for the long haul, right? That's sort of the ethos of preservation. So I'm excited to hear about the potential for a symposium, because I think that there's so much in this story that, like you keep saying, needs to be unpacked and understood, because it's not just a Charleston story. There are organizations around the country looking to this and thinking through what's happening in their backyard and a resource perhaps that they care for. So I think that there's a lot of value in understanding this. So where does this leave the rest of the strategic plan? Is there anything nearly as concerning or controversial, or are you still driving forward with the rest of it?
Yeah, we are. Obviously, this sort of, it was a little bit of a derailment, and we, and frankly, we now are sort of having to, in this part of this advisory committee that we put together, is going to be sort of, this will be an addendum to this, which will be focused on the museums, which will then plug in. With the original plan, we're going to, as we called it, doubling down with the Aiken Red House because of the needs there, but also the opportunities to tell these incredible stories are so unique there. But we also have that opportunity at the Russell House. And so, the advocacy piece, part of really what drove it, as I said, when I read the new mission is, Charleston is undergoing so much change. I mean, we've gotten super involved in flooding and sea level rise issues, which if you'd asked me 10 years ago if that was going to be a big part of our advocacy, I would have laughed. I would have been, what are you talking about? No, that's not, we don't do that. But that's become a huge thing. And that's an existential issue, frankly, for the peninsula, but also the broader, Lowcountry. And it takes a lot of time and energy. We've got a huge affordable housing crisis here, like many sought after communities around the country, and we've started something called the Common Cause Loan Fund, which is a sort of subsidiary of our revolving fund. And it's a loan program, a forgivable loan program to preserve existing affordable housing, which is, privately owned, basically legacy homeowners, as we call them, generational homeowners who live in historic properties. We're focusing on the peninsula right now, but we have done some properties outside of, but give loaning money to repair roofs and siding and windows. It's mainly envelope repairs. We don't get into interiors really, but, and we've had a great partner at, unsurprisingly, in the 1772 Foundation has been very interested in our leadership in the sort of intersection of preservation and affordable housing, and has been very supportive of our efforts over the years and of this effort. And it has gotten a lot of philanthropic interest. And we actually are very excited about a nice congressionally directed chunk of money that's coming through Lindsey Graham's office to help this program, which we're very excited about. We also are seeking other large scale, funding for that, because it's a crisis and it's helping a lot of we're having a huge cultural exodus in the city of Charleston, where lower income and predominantly African Americans can't afford to live on the peninsula anymore. And it's changing the demographics and the kind of cultural fabric of our city. And that's huge. And while we can't stop that, we can't stop gentrification and displacement, anything we can do to try to keep the people who are still here that are a key part of our neighborhoods and communities which make Charleston so rich culturally, we really want to do. And so this Common Cause program is a big part of our strategic plan, and we are moving ahead full steam on that, which we're very excited about. You know, we have a new mayor, and there's a lot of planning issues going on around the future of not just the peninsula, but the city of Charleston. There's a whole zoning code rewrite. So, I mean, there's a lot of advocacy issues working with settlement communities in the rural areas, African-American settlement communities. So all those advocacy things. And that was what sort of drove, it's really a bandwidth and capacity thing, and sort of this idea of we kind of need, you know, we have some major issues that our community needs of us, and we need to rise to the occasion. So the question is, how do you do it all, right? That's what I have funders coming to me, donors saying, well, you know, you said you needed to sort of focus, now you're not. So what does that look like? And, you know, so we're going to need to look at creative sources of funding. We do not, you know, tap into government funding very much, but we are talking about trying to work more, particularly at the state level, to get some support. You know, so we're looking at some other areas, and, you know, we need to bulk up on the staff side, which, of course, as you know, in running a nonprofit, you know, the payroll is the biggest line item typically in your budget. But it's important. You got to have the staff and the capacity to do this work. And so, you know, my hope is that through this conversation in Charleston in particular, that people, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, while it was a painful process and it was, I did not have a fun holiday, I sort of had to hide out some, but, and there were bumper stickers made about me. And anyway, it was, it got kind of personal and painful. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, some of the we got a lot of coverage in the local newspaper and TV news. And, you know, at the end of the day, it shows that people are watching and they're paying attention to what you're doing. And so we have to remind ourselves of that. And that we are relevant, but you have to evolve, in my mind, to remain relevant. And that's the process we're going through right now. But we're very excited about the future. We're very focused on the future. You know, we're really kind of done with trying to figure out what we could have done better or what, you know, we really are focused. And my board is 100% committed to both museum properties, understanding, you know, we have heard and we are going to respond in kind, and we're going to invest what's needed to make these excellent, you know, examples of house museums in 2024 and beyond. But exactly what that looks like is yet to be determined, but stay tuned. And, you know, as you said, I mean, I'd love to continue the conversation and pull in colleagues from around the country to sort of help frame some of these issues, because I do think it's very important.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think there's a lot here for anyone who works in any different aspect of preservation, because this story touches on all of it. Like you said, continuing the conversation, we need to have you back in a year or so and see where you're at and see how this story continues to write itself. Before we go, we normally ask folks if they have a favorite historic place or site, which obviously yours is Nathaniel Russell. You know, I mean, there's right. Just no question about that. We'll forgive that question today. But sometimes the fallback, if people are unwilling to answer that, is the most recent book they're reading to kind of give us a little insight to where your mind is right now.
Oh gosh. Fiction, I don't read a ton of nonfiction. I have to, and maybe that's going to burst the bubble that I'm not reading, you know, history books all the time. But, I just read James McBride's Good Lord Bird. I don't know if you've read that.
Yeah, sure.
But it's an excellent, excellent book. I just finished that, a couple of weeks ago.
It's sort of historical fiction, though. I mean, you're kind of,
yeah, of course. It's got the Harper's Ferry raid, which of course is near and dear to you. But it that was a I just loved it. I thought it was great writing. And you know, it actually, and sort of maybe apropos of this conversation, which is, you know, how you make history relevant to new audiences. You know, not everybody is a history nerd. Not everybody is a historic house nerd. And that's the challenge that we have is how do you make, it is about storytelling. It's about making these places relevant to people. And you know, we have seen, even in Charleston, the sort of the visitor profile is shifting. People are coming here. I mean, we're not New Orleans yet or Nashville, but you know, it is, people are coming here to drink and party and eat. And their idea of history, engaging in history, is to snap a selfie in front of Rainbow Row. So with knowing that, like, how do you engage younger audiences and people who aren't, you know, sort of programmed to go to a house museum or frankly to a plantation site or whatever else. You know, that's sort of been our bread and butter for so long, and it's been sort of the brand of Charleston, but a visitor interest is shifting. And so the onus is on us to figure out how to meet people where they are. You know, it's easy to sit in your ivory tower and be like, well, those people are so dumb and they don't know history and, you know, shame on them. But that, you know, at the end of the day, the onus is on us to determine how we can meet them where they are and inspire them and engage them on history and culture and the past and architecture and all the things that we love. So, you know, I feel like that book kind of did a good job. It sort of, you know, it was, there's a lot of creative license, but it was such an awesome story.
Well, that's like a perfect way, like you said, to sort of put a capstone on the conversation about how do we engage the next generation? How do we breathe life into these places and the places that people have made it abundantly clear they want saved? How do we make them relevant and exciting and appealing?
And challenge those people to come. You know, a lot of the people who are the loudest voices, I'm like, when was the last time you actually came to the Nathaniel Russell House? Or have you ever come to the Nathaniel Russell House? Or when you have family in town, do you bring them there? Or do you come to lectures? Or, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
There is a little bit, and it's figuring out how to do that in a way that doesn't seem, you know, bitter, but you kind of have to say, All right, so you said you love this place. Well, show me.
I love it. And we're all looking to this and trying to understand it and appreciate you joining us to share a little bit of that insight. Thanks so much for joining us today, Winslow.
Listen, Nick, thank you for your interest. Thank you for what you do with PreserveCast. It's such a cool thing. It's amazing what you've done with Preservation Maryland and all the work with the building trades and everything else. I'm a huge fan of your work and honored to be a part of this podcast. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to PreserveCast. To dig deeper into this episode's story, head over to preservecast.org for show notes and our collection of previous episodes. Don't forget to engage with this podcast by subscribing, commenting, and leaving a review. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at PreserveCast for even more. PreserveCast is currently recorded in Walkersville, Maryland, and sponsored by the 1772 Foundation and powered by Preservation Maryland. Thanks for listening and keep on preserving.